First case for argument, Harshevsky v. Gweeden Corporation. Mr. Rifkin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Rifkin, and I represent Erica Harshevsky and Victor Valenzuela, who are two former employees of Gweeden Corporation and were participants in the Gweeden Employee Stock Savings and Ownership Plan. The plan was offered to Gweeden employees to encourage safe retirement savings. The plaintiffs alleged below that the defendants, who are all fiduciaries of the plan pursuant to ERISA, breached their fiduciary duty to the plan and its participants by offering Gweeden common stock when it was imprudent to do so for the following three reasons. First, the defendants knew or should have known of potentially fatal manufacturing defects in the company's principal product, a heart defibrillator. Second, the defendants knew or should have known that these defects were concealed from the public, in part to facilitate and then to protect a merger with Johnson & Johnson Company that was announced in late 2004 and consummated in 2005. Third, the common stock of the company was placed at great risk, both because of the problems with the defibrillators and also because the market did not understand the risks that the company faced, and therefore the stock was overpriced during the class period that's alleged in our complaint. The principal issue on this appeal is whether former participants in a stock retirement plan, one of whom was still a participant when she commenced the action, have standing to bring claims under ERISA Section 502A, where the benefits they received in the form of lump sum payments when they left the plan were diminished because of the alleged wrongdoing on the part of the defendants. The court below dismissed the case, concluding that there was no standing, and we have timely appealed. I have conceded a significant portion of my time to the Secretary of Labor, who will be addressing some of the policy issues that this appeal raises. I would like to confine my remarks, hopefully, to areas that the Secretary of Labor will not be addressing. To begin,
so
I would
what,
like to
what are the damages that you think your clients sustained?
Your Honor, in these cases, the measure of damages is the difference between the performance of guidance stock during the class period when compared against what the plaintiffs believe would have been a more prudent investment. In this case, we would look at the guidance performance in the market, and we would compare it, for example, against some of the other investment options that were offered by the plan, or perhaps some other investment options that were not offered but which the plaintiff, through an expert witness, would explain to have been more prudent. And ERISA permits the plan to recover the difference between the actual performance of the stock on the one hand, measured against what the performance should have been if the assets of the plan had been more prudently invested. We believe that no Supreme Court decision and no circuit court decision has addressed this narrow question.
But now, Gweeden originally was, eventually was sold at a very good price to Boston Scientific.
That's correct, Your Honor. After the class.
What loss, so what was the damage to your clients? They ended up with a Boston Scientific stock, right?
Well, they ended up with Johnson & Johnson stock in a takeover battle.
They got a good price, didn't they, from Boston Scientific?
Well, the issue, there's two answers to that. In the first instance, the damages we believe are appropriately measured by the performance of the stock during the class period and subsequent events.
Didn't they end up very well as a result of the Boston Scientific acquisition?
Except that since then, as more bad news has come out about the problems that were plaguing the company, that stock too has sagged, and so they have lost money.
But those reasons have to do with Boston Scientific, not have to do with Gweeden.
Well, actually, it has to do with the problems relating to Gweeden's business, the business that was acquired.
Boston Scientific had its own problems.
As well, yes.
Yeah. How on earth are you going to separate out the problems due to Boston Scientific's own difficulties and problems of guidance? I don't see how you could possibly prove damages here.
Your Honor, the same way that
prove your clients were any better off.
Well,
would have been any better off but for the Johnson deal.
Let me answer that two ways. First, let me explain that even if the company had profited and even if the shareholders in the plan had profited, they are still entitled to make a claim that they should have profited even more so in this plan.
That's pie in the sky. How could you possibly show they would have profited even more?
Your Honor, we believe that an expert is able to assimilate all of the information that was released in the market, including information about the transaction, including the subsequent announcements about the problems with the company and about the lingering problems with Guidant. And we believe that an expert could explain why the announcements about the additional problems caused further losses in the stock. And we believe that the measure of damages would still be appropriate.
Recouped by this $80 price that Boston Scientific paid. How could you show that they would have done better with other stock?
Well, in the first place, the deal occurred after the class period ended. And so we believe...
What difference does that make?
Because
damages are determined as of the date of trial, not the date when the class closes.
I agree with that completely, Your Honor. However, it is our argument, it is the plaintiff's argument, that the assets of the plan should have been more prudently invested during a particular period in time. Now, I grant you that following the merger...
You wouldn't have gotten them the $80.
Following the merger, there was a short period of time when this stock performed very well. But that time has also gone because the stock has no longer performed that well. And so you are quite correct.
It hasn't gone, but you're not going to be able to separate out the causes of its decline as between Guidant continued problems and Boston Scientific's own problems, the whole stent business.
I see that I am now eating into the time that I have reserved for rebuttal, but I would like to answer your question. With respect, those kinds of determinations are made routinely in securities cases because, as Your Honor is well aware, we have to prove in securities cases, for example, we have to prove a causal relationship between a particular misstatement or omission of fact and the resulting inflation in the company's stock. These are matters that experts opine on all the time in cases all over the country, which is to say, attributing a particular...
This case is unique because of the acquisition of Guidant at a very, very high price by Boston Scientific, followed by further vicissitudes in that stock price. It's much more complicated than the standard securities fraud case.
The principle that you've asked, however, it remains the same, is whether it is possible for the plaintiff to introduce evidence, whether it's expert evidence or some other form of evidence.
What would some other form of evidence be?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it is appropriate in these cases to compare the overall performance of the stock, on the one hand, as Guidant stock performed historically, and on the other hand, as what we believe a more prudent investment would have performed.
What is a more prudent investment? Is that just what the stock market did as a whole?
Well, I've suggested some examples, one of which is some of the other options that were available in the plan. Another is, for example, the S&P 500.
Available to the plan.
During the class period, there were a number of options, including, for example, mutual funds. And there were a variety of...
performed. Are you going to pick out the best performing and say that's the benchmark?
We would actually, when we look at these cases, we actually don't pick any single performer. We pick a number of performers, and we try to give the fact finder an opportunity to decide what would have been...
The ones that do well, right?
Well, Your Honor, we pick the ones that our experts tell us are more prudent investments than the stock that's at issue. If they are better performers, then we believe that the overall performance, without having to try to allocate a particular dollar loss to a particular announcement or event, is an appropriate measure of damages in ERISA cases. But I think we're getting way ahead of ourselves here when the issue is standing. I'm happy to address these issues, and I believe that the law as it's developing in the ERISA cases permits the plaintiff, without regard to what caused the particular dollar movement in the stock, to look at the prudence of the stock during a particular period and compare it with the performance of a stock or an index or a mutual fund or some other retirement savings mechanism that would allow the jury to determine the damages by comparing the performance of the more prudent investment with the performance of the company in question. And we don't think that it's necessary for an expert to attribute any particular dollar value to any particular fact issue in the case. We think the prudence is the overall issue, not, for example, whether it was a defibrillator or some other particular factor that caused the price of the stock to move $1 or $2 one way or the other. I see that my time is up, and if the court has any more questions,
so thank
I'm happy
you, Mr.
to respond to them.
Ms. Hopkins?
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Hopkins, and I'm here on behalf of the Secretary of Labor as amicus curiae in support of the plaintiff's appellants in this case. The Secretary agrees with the plaintiffs that as former employees of Guidant, they have statutory standing to sue on behalf of their defined contribution plan for breaches that occurred while they were before they had left the plan and that allegedly resulted in losses to the plan and a resulting decrease in the amount that they received on payout. The statute allows a plan participant to sue plan fiduciaries and requires those fiduciaries to make good, personally make good any losses that occurred to the plan that were caused by their fiduciary breaches. And the statute very broadly defines the term participant as any employee or former employee who is or may become eligible to receive a benefit of any kind from an employee benefit plan. In Firestone, the Supreme Court held that a former...
So what statutory provision are you relying on?
It's the definition in section...
No, what section you rely on for the right to obtain damages in this case?
The plaintiffs have brought suit under Section 502A2 of ERISA, which is 1132A2 of 29 U.S.C. That allows a plan participant, a beneficiary, the fiduciary of the plan, or the Secretary of Labor to bring suit for losses to the plan. It references Section 409 of ERISA, which allows suit for any losses to the plan. And that is the suit that is the provision that's being sued under.
About appropriate relief?
This is about losses to the plan under 1132. It's in Section 409 of ERISA, which is referenced in Section 502A2. Allows for appropriate relief under Section 409, and then 409 in turn speaks of losses to the plan. It allows the participant to recoup those losses to the plan or any profits that the fiduciaries obtained through their breaches. In Firestone, the Supreme Court held that a former participant meets this definition, a former employee meets the definition of participant so long as he has a colorable claim to vested benefits under his plan. And the plaintiffs here meet this statutory definition because they claim that fiduciary breaches with regard to the guidance stock component of their defined contribution plan caused losses to the plan and caused a corresponding loss to the amount in their individual accounts within the plan and therefore to the amount that they received on payout. And because this is a defined contribution plan and their benefits were directly tied to the performance of the plan's assets in the investments and particularly in this investment in guidance stock, if they prevail on their suit to recover losses to the plan, they will be entitled to the payment of additional benefits from the plan.
It is quite different from a defined benefit setting, isn't it?
Yes.
Benefit plan, you have a defined benefit, a specified benefit. You don't get it, you sue. But here we have to get into all this business about how the stock would have performed since it's a defined contribution plan.
That's correct.
It turns this just into a complicated securities fraud case.
Well, it turns it into a more complicated, I would say, calculation. But the same was true in the Summers case in the Fifth Circuit, where the allegation was that the stock had not been properly valued. And that was closely held stock, so there was actually a very difficult calculation that was going to have to take place in the Summers case in order to ascertain what the correct price of that stock was. And nevertheless, the court said that that the plaintiffs there had standing in Summers because the court, I'm going to quote the court, the Fifth Circuit, they said if the class prevailed on its claims, the representatives would be entitled to receive a benefit, which was the difference between what they got and what they should have gotten if there had been no fiduciary breaches. And that's really precisely the claim here. And the same result, the finding of statutory standing, really ought to pertain. Although this court really has never addressed the issue, the precise issue in this case.
What is it you think that, how do you pronounce this anyway? Guidon? Guidon?
It's Guidon.
Guidon. So what is it you think the Guidon trustees should have done?
Well, we're not taking a position on the merits of the case, but the allegations of the case are that that the fiduciaries knew that the price of the stock did not accurately reflect the true situation at the company. Therefore, it was overvalued during the class period. And so the plan was essentially...
They got this terrific price from Boston Scientific.
Yes, I think that's right. But the allegation is at the time that they purchased the stock, the plan purchased the stock, it was paying too much, and the fiduciaries knew that. That's the measure of losses, the amount of the overpayment. You could either say that they paid...
I understand. So you're saying Boston Scientific was taken in also.
I'm not sure. I think by that point the disclosures had been made about the situation at the company. But again, these are factual issues, and I'm just trying to explain my understanding of the complaint and
you're
the allegations.
You're just taking a position
of
standing, not anything else.
That's correct. The secretary only addressed the issue of standing, and the basic point is that under this court's decisions in cases like Panaris and Claire. And even Winchester, the court really eschewed an overly narrow and technical reading of the standing requirement, of the vested benefit requirement, really, from the Firestone case. And significantly...
Well, if they couldn't sue under ERISA, could they sue under, Rule 10b-5?
I think there's a possibility that there could be a securities suit, but it's worth noting that, the standard... under security suit is, as I understand it, is fraud. Under ERISA, it's breach of fiduciary duty, which is the highest, has been, repeatedly said to be the highest standard known to the law. It's really a different sort of suit, and it's a higher standard. It's a lesser standard of pleading, and perhaps even a different measure of damages. And there's nothing in ERISA or in the securities laws that precludes a suit under both sets of laws.
Why should ERISA permit plaintiffs to avoid the high pleading standards and proof standards of securities law, since all they're complaining about is a securities violation?
Well, they're also complaining that they were owed a duty by the fiduciaries to the plan. This is different than the duty that the company may have owed to stockholders or to the general public, that they, as participants in the plan, were owed a level of fiduciary care that's the highest known to the law of prudence and loyalty, that was breached and that they were harmed as a result, and they ought to be able to bring suit under ERISA to recover those kinds of losses, and that's a position.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hopkins.
Here. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ortelier.
Brian Ortelier, and I represent the Guidon Appellees. First, I'd like to take a couple of minutes and rebut some of the points made by my opponents before circling back and drilling down specifically on the statute. Basically, Your Honor, we submit and certainly that the Boston Scientific offer that comes along after the fact and pays, I think, $6 more per share after the information found its way into the market proves conclusively at the end of the day that there really can't be a finding of damages here, but equally importantly, I think, underscores the complexity of the inquiry. Now, I may take issue with whether or not the Fifth Circuit's opinion in Summers applies here, but Summers speaks to a continuum. It says if the recovery is something akin to a rote or mechanical undertaking, like determining the benefit of a plan, then these former employees, by the way, who voluntarily took their money out of the plan, nobody made them do that. We wouldn't be here today but for that fact. And further to that point, there are many, many thousands of employees who left their money in who would be able to prosecute this lawsuit. I think it's telling, by the way, that they're not pressing the claims against this company, in part because of the good fortune that the Boston Scientific offer demonstrates. And by the way, the Boston Scientific offer, it's quite convenient for these plaintiffs to completely, and I submit, arbitrarily set forth a class period, borrowing, I would say, from 10b-5 jurisprudence, which is an important point not to lose sight of here. But what these plaintiffs come in and say is, during some period, this was obviously an imprudent investment, ignoring completely the very, very special reasons why these investments are made available to employees. This is employer stock. They are qualified employer securities, which are carved out for special treatment of ERISA. And I point out the Boston Scientific offer, not just to underscore the point that there could not possibly be an award of damages here, but to say again, if the test comes from Summers, and I may take issue with that, this is certainly not some sort of easy rote calculation by the plaintiff's own admissions. What they're saying, again, first, we've got to look at, or as the court suggests, the Boston Scientific offer. Was the class period too narrow? Complicated issues, I submit, that would be determined in large measure by the Supreme Court's recent opinion on loss causation in Dura Pharmaceuticals, which, by the way, and I think the counsels conceded the point, these plaintiffs, this plan has available to it a remedy in the companion 10b-5 suit, where precisely the same allegations of inflation. Now, I have to say I hear two different theories being bandied about, price inflation at times and a prudence claim grounded in the notion that the plan fiduciaries should have looked to some other investment. I think it's critical to note, and again, I was focusing for a moment there on some of the questions from the court, that this plan has eight other investment options in it outside of the ESOP. And participants control their money. They invest it as they see fit. To the extent, if ever, a court were to try to begin to fashion an appropriate remedy here, it would have to, and again, their theory is at some point in time, the fiduciaries should have sold off the stock, stopped new money coming in, and reinvest the money. Again, and unfortunately I see this in some of my other cases, the argument is always that there's some singular investment that well outperformed the guidance stock. But what would have to happen here is that that money would have to flow back into the plan, into the accounts, as directed by the individual participants, if you're going to use some kind of lost opportunity model. Each participant directs and controls their own investments. They have their own sort of horizons, their own time, their own risk and reward considerations that are personal to them. But the point I'm trying to make is, if you assume, and again, the plaintiff's theories are somewhat inconsistent and may be, in fact, mutually or incompatible with one another. But let's assume for a moment that you've got this remedy available, and it's they're looking to the Second Circuit's opinion in Beerworth. Well, then the most reasonable place to stick that money would be to reinvest it among pro rata across their other investments. It's the only sensible option when you're dealing with these types of participant-controlled plans. But the point I'm trying to make is this is no easy benefits calculation. And Beerworth itself says when you're dealing with a fraud-on-the-market type theory, then you don't use this lost opportunity cost model, which I submit for these plaintiffs means at the end of the day they only have possibly a fraud-on-the-market theory. As the Fifth Circuit held the other day, and it's cited in my brief in the electronic data EDS opinion. Again, you've got this myriad causation problems.
Now, what did they say?
The Fifth Circuit vacated a class certification ruling and basically said because in this type of defined contribution plan, and here after age 50, for example, the participants can move their money around.
Don't digress. I want to know what did the Fifth Circuit
say. The Fifth Circuit specifically vacated a interlocutory 23F appeal, a class certification ruling, and they looked at, by the way, under 502A2, I hope I'm not getting a field and rein me back in, but what they said under 502A2, you can't have this type of claim here because all of the myriad individualized causation problems, which tells me, again, and I think it's a reason not to twist the statutory provisions well beyond recognition, this plan is a putative class member in the companion securities action. And that, I think, is important to the court. Drilling a little down, further down on Summers, which again, they cite, I'm sorry.
It's like our Summers case, S-U instead of S-O. So although we said there was no remedy, we assumed that the participants in an ESOP could complain about imprudent behavior by the...
Well, I think, Your Honor, they can complain of imprudent behavior. That certainly begs the question of whether these two plaintiffs have standing. But now, turning to the merits, as I think guided by your opinion in Summers.
A case where the trustee was clearly imprudent. And, we suggested in Summers that you could have a situation where the decline in the stock price was creating so much risk for the employees that a prudent trustee would sell. So suppose that's the case. Why would it be critical whether an individual had taken his pathetic, money out in disgust? Stock price is dropping, but he leaves anyway. And if he remained, then he'd have standing. But on your view, if he leaves, he doesn't have standing. He takes his money and runs. Why should that be critical?
Well, I think you're on...
What is there in 502A2 or elsewhere that would prevent treating that person as an injured participant?
You know, Your Honor, the answer is in ERISA Section 3.7, which is the definition of participant. And what Congress did was narrow the scope of parties having standing to sue. And there's reasons for that, I submit, particularly when you're looking at investments in employer stock. By what I submit, proper application of the standing rules, all we're asking is that these participants have some sort of skin in the game, which I think at the end of the day is a requirement given the competing considerations that your opinion in Summers explains why this stock is special. And again, I'm not certain it's asking too much that either a current participant or someone with an account balance step up and bring the lawsuit. Now, interestingly, Your Honor, and this we've argued in the district court, and I'll admit to having been remiss in not making the point in this brief, Congress polices this area very, very carefully. And again, as the Supreme Court reminds us from time to time, ERISA is a reticulated statute. The courts are not to create causes of action or where the statute doesn't expressly provide. Back in the late 80s and early 90s,
well, you're saying former participant is someone who is seeking damages rather than benefits. Isn't that what your argument comes to?
At the end of the day, clearly, Your Honor, but the court asked why draw the distinction between present and former participants. But I would point out that back in 1994, Congress stepped in and added 502A9, 1132A9. What happened back in the day, a number of life insurance companies were seized by state insurance commissioners, and their ability to honor their contractual commitments under what are called termination annuities. When a defined benefit plan is terminated, what a plan sponsor will do, it will arrange for an insurance company to step in and pay the benefit. A lump sum comes out of the plan, and that money is turned over to the insurance company, who pays the benefit for the lifetime of the former employee. Now, courts were then holding, back in the day, having received a lump sum payment and a termination annuity, these individuals didn't have standing to sue. Now, Congress stepped in 1994 and added 502A9 and said that very, very narrow subclass who receives termination annuities from a defined benefit pension plan indeed has standing to sue. It's very narrow. I submit it doesn't apply here. But I would underscore for the court the simple fact that Congress polices this area carefully. It is a question for Congress. The answer is in the language of the statute.
Why would someone who no longer, as you put it, has an account balance present less of a concrete adverseness in this litigation than somebody who does have an account balance?
Well, interestingly, the problem becomes particularly acute when we're dealing with employer stock. As this Court's Summers, with a U, opinion says,
The question, if I understand it, was why is there a difference?
Again, because of this tension between the plaintiffs here are saying you should have stripped and jettisoned this investment employer stock, by the way, at a time when these folks, through what's called the pass-through voting feature of the investment, are called upon to vote on the Johnson & Johnson merger. This interest is near and dear. Remaining invested in employer stock, I think, is more important to the current array of employees. And for these folks to step in later and say that, notwithstanding the fact that the Boston Scientific offer was great.
Employer stock or other stock is not germane to the distinction between vested benefits and damages, right?
Well, what is
distinction to employer stock.
But if the court, again, were to look at, as Firestone says, are we talking about vested benefits? Your Honor, you pointed out, again, the statutory language and the plan only affords people their account balances, nothing more. It doesn't say something like whatever you might receive in a fraud-on-the-market type theory later.
If the balance in your account is defined contribution plan, if the balance is low because you've got dumb trustees, that gives you a damages suit for breach of fiduciary duty, but it doesn't give you a suit for benefits because you got your benefits. Is that what you're saying?
Right. 502A1B tells us what a benefit is, and it's measured by the terms of the plan. The plan says you get your account balance, nothing more. And yes, Your Honor, I agree.
He was making your argument for you.
I'm sorry?
You were supposed to be agreeing with yourself. He was making the argument.
I realize that.
It takes a while for you to get there.
A nanosecond
I'm not
later.
Sure, I'm not sure that you've answered Judge Ripple's question. Are you satisfied with the answer, Judge Ripple?
Well, it seems... I just still don't see why somebody who's a couple of years out and says he got nailed by this doggone plan has any less of a... brings any less concrete adverseness to this litigation than somebody who's still employed by the company.
I think the answer, Your Honor, resides in ERISA Section 3.7.
You mean the statute precludes this?
Yes, absolutely.
Specifically.
Because it requires, again, as the Supreme Court construed it, and they're not
We're not talking about the Supreme Court. We're just talking about the Congressional Act. You wander off fairly rapidly.
I'm sorry. ERISA Section 3.7 specifically limits a former employee to someone who is to receive a benefit from the plan. These folks have had their accounts terminated. The plan is not a party to this action. This court held in the JASS case, J-A-S-S, when you're seeking a benefit, the plan has to be a party. It would take, I submit, a variety of...
Well, you started out by saying the Act Congress has precluded this lawsuit. I simply wanted to know where that occurred.
ERISA Section 3.7 is the operative language, Your Honor. But I would simply add...
So you're saying you can only get benefits from the plan. You can't get benefits from the trustee. You could just get damages from the trustees for their doing something dumb, but... they're not the plan, so they don't pay benefits. Is that a...
I agree, Your Honor. And unless there are any further questions...
That would be true equally if this were a suit by existing participants, right?
Existing participants have a right to
But suppose they're suing the trustees. If existing participants sue trustees rather than the plan, wouldn't your argument be that they cannot sue because they're necessarily suing for damages if they're suing trustees or the corporation rather than the plan?
It's not. The case law says that a current participant / employee, also looking to 3.7, who has a right to a benefit, can also sue for the other remedies available under the statute. I cannot take the argument.
502A2, you mean?
Excuse me?
Under 502A2.
Yes.
So you do have a rather fragile distinction.
I'm sorry?
You do have a rather fragile distinction.
I think, Your Honor, that the statute itself makes this clear. And again, if Congress does police this area, and these folks, or at least the plan itself, which a 502A2409 claim, what it envisions is a payment into the plan. That's precisely the same remedy sought in the securities action. And by the way, 29 U.S.C. section, I think it's 1140.
Your time has expired, right, so I have to ask you.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Rifkin, you don't have any time, but we'll give you a minute if you have something.
Your Honors, thank you very much. I will try to be very brief. First, let me address one of the points that was made at the very end of my opponent's argument. I think the court's decision in Clare versus Harris Trust really addresses this question exactly. There, the claim was that the plaintiff had been delayed payment by the defendants in liquidating their plan accounts. They asked to have their plans liquidated. They submitted the request, and the plan trustee simply took too long, as the plaintiffs alleged, in getting them their checks. And Judge Posner, you addressed this question of standing, and you said that in that case, which I submit is closer to a claim for damages than the claim we have here, you concluded that the plaintiff had standing to bring a claim because that was essentially a claim for the denial of benefits. And although you ultimately concluded that the claim had no merit, you certainly allowed the plaintiff to have standing in that case.
Actually, he was just speaking for the court. He wasn't just shooting off his mouth privately. You know?
No, and I did not mean to suggest that. Of course not. The Seventh Circuit made that decision, and we believe that if you put that case on the continuum of benefits on the one hand and damages on the other, that case is closer to a claim for damages, but still close enough to a claim for benefits to be within the Supreme Court's definition in the Firestone case. This case is even closer to benefits.
How can you have a good suit after R. Summers' case, right? I mean, R. Summers' case explains, you know, trustees who have employer stock are in a fix, right? They don't want to sell their employer stock.
I think there are a number of important...
Of course, in this case, you know, it's very sensible to hold on to it and have this great sale to Boston Scientific.
So. Your Honor, I think there are a number of important issues to be taken from the Summers case, one of which is it was a motion for summary judgment, not a motion to dismiss. Another of which is it was an ESOP. It was an employee stock ownership plan whose principal purpose was to buy company stock.
ESOP component, right?
Your Honor, this is a single...
What you're complaining about, their sale of the employer stock.
This is a single integrated plan that was not an ESOP. This was an EIAP. It had an ESOP component. But the overall purpose for this plan was not an ESOP purpose. It is not subject to the special rules that apply to ESOPs. It applies instead, the plan in this case is subject to the more general rules that apply to EIAP trustees, and so I believe the duty on the part of these trustees was even higher than the duty Your Honor expounded on in the Summers versus State Street Bank case. Third, I would point out that the trustees in the Summers versus State Street Bank case were directed trustees, which is to say they were one step removed from the defendants who we have in this case. And by the way, we have not asserted a claim against the plan in this case. We have asserted a claim on behalf of the plan. However, we have included a class component because there are, quite properly, there are former employees of the plan, and the only way to include them, in the relief is by the class action mechanism. But the principal relief that we seek is a restoring of benefits that should have been earned in the accounts in the plan. And so I believe that my opponent may have said something about a claim against the plan, and I just wanted to make sure that we clarified that. Finally, I want to say that we did not at any time concede that our appropriate remedy is under the securities laws. I believe that Congress has seen fit to give us a remedy under ERISA, and the Supreme Court and this Court and several others have seen fit to recognize that remedy as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Both sides, or all three sides.